Thank you. Your Honor, this is an appeal from an amended judgment and decree of dissolution of marriage and several post-trial orders and a judgment entered thereafter. There are multiple issues in the case. Briefly, appellant asserts that the trial court erred by erroneously computing the child support obligation and the PICS percentage by not including the spousal maintenance received by the wife in income in making the calculation.
That's conceded, isn't it?
Or yeah, is that in dispute? So, yes. Okay. They say it's moot, but it's not moot. It has to go back to the trial court to be corrected.
So we would need to remand for that purpose.
I'm sorry?
We would need to remand for that purpose.
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I think you have to. I mean, that's my belief. We also have to compute how that's going to be paid back, because it's the child support has been paid since, I believe, August of 2018. So, okay. The second issue is the trial court erred by making a non-marital award of the proceeds of sale of the party's homestead and in Northfield. I'm going to call it a Northfield property. and if there is a non-marital share, erroneously computed the amount of it. There are two issues of attorney's fees. The appeal asserts that the trial court erred by deleting an award of conduct-based fees, which were originally awarded to the husband in the amended decree, which is the original decree, claiming that there was a lack of finding to support it. And the trial court also erred by not deleting an award of $10,000 of needs-based attorney's fees to wife. So to kind of clear it up, the original judgment decree awarded $10,000 to the wife needs-based, $6,000 to the husband conduct-based, and then when the motion was made post-trial, the trial court deleted the $6,000 awarded to the husband, left the $10,000 awarded to wife, and we're appealing both the decision to delete and to allow it in. Essentially, what that issue involves is about findings, and I'll describe it more briefly when I get into it. It also asserts that there was a motion by the wife to enforce and amend the judgment decree, which was filed on 4/18/19, long after the time to file a motion for amended findings. Which resulted in
just allowing the finalization of the dissolution. I mean, that it doesn't alter the division of the assets, correct?
Well,
it's the same. I know you've got issues about the non-marital, but tell me how it's wrong to say and now go ahead and finalize and distribute the assets.
Well,
as the trial court has previously ordered.
The parties stipulated that the tangible personal property would be sold. There was quite a bit of money. And stipulated that two items should be taken out of that. Pardon me. It was stipulated that the amounts would be distributed to the parties equally, except there were two items that were specifically stated in the judgment decree, that the husband had to pay about $8,000 to the wife out of his share, and the wife had to pay about $1,700 out of her share to the husband. That was a stipulated agreement, and what the motion did, and there's no claim that there's any ambiguity in that. When the motion did, it says that they call it an enforcement motion, but it's not really enforcement. It actually amends the decree to use the monies that were stipulated to be distributed to the parties equally to pay attorney's fees to the wife, that's the $10,000, and also to pay a non-marital claim. The stipulated judgment decree did not provide non-marital claim. It didn't have any non-marital claim in it, and did not provide that that non-marital claim nor the attorney fees award should be paid out of it. Now, the legal issue in it is that counsel for the wife, the respondent says, oh, this is just an enforcement thing. It didn't change the substantive rights. Now, I submit to you it did, because the order that came out is not supported by the evidence. They have a whole mass of information.
Let me interrupt you just for a second. So is your argument on the motion to enforce just the issues you've appealed about the non-marital and the need-based attorney fee award? So you're saying that the motion to enforce is invalid because you're appealing and believe that the non-marital percentage should not be awarded to the wife, and neither should the need-based attorney's fees?
Well, I'm saying it's all erroneous, but fundamentally, it's a lack of jurisdiction. This was a stipulated property provision. Minstat 518.145 sub 1 says it's final. Okay, subject only to appeal. It wasn't appealed. There's no notice of review by the wife in the case. Now, but the issue is that there's no allegation that the decree with that respect to that division of personal property sale was ambiguous, okay? And secondly, that because it was stipulated, the rule that says you can just enforce things does not apply. In a stipulated property settlement, you cannot change the judgment decree at all simply to enforce it.
But the judgment decree was changed. I mean, there is a subsequent order ordering non-marital, the non-marital, the 7% share to the wife.
Yes.
And so doesn't the district court have the power to enforce its own orders?
It can, but it can't amend the decree, which was that property part of the decree, which was stipulated unambiguously that it would be divided equally. Now, what they've done is that they've changed that property portion of the decree, claiming that, oh, this is just enforcement, so we're going to grab all of the non-marital property that was awarded subsequently to the judgment decree from that, and they can't do that.
Let me back you up, and maybe this gets into some of your earlier issues in challenging the award of the non-marital assets. But the wife, throughout, has claimed that she is entitled to a percentage of the homestead for the non-marital funds she used for the down payment. And then it seems like the court initially thought it shouldn't be awarded, and then the court changed its mind and said, oh, you know what? I was wrong as a matter of law, and I think she is entitled to a percentage, you know, under Schmitz v. Schmitz and, you know, related precedent. So isn't that right? And so then why can't the court enforce that order? And then why don't you actually get into your argument on the non-marital award?
I'm repeating myself, but I'll put it this way. There were two buckets of money in this case. It was the sale of the home, which was post-decree. That was one bucket of money, and that was to be divided equally, and there was the sale of the tangible personal property, and that was a bucket of money. The sale of the tangible personal property very clearly and explicitly laid out how that was going to be distributed. I mean, it's crystal clear. There were only these two items, otherwise it was going to be divided equally. Now, if there was going to be any enforcement of this decree, it should have been out of the bucket of money for the real estate. But instead, what happened was that the parties, pursuant to their own stipulated agreement to divide that equally too, received the distribution. So what the wife's motion was is that, oh, I'm going to dump the whole decree. I'm going to take the money that was supposed to come out of one bucket and take it out of the other.
Well,
and they can't do that, and I'm repeating myself, because it was stipulated, and it's unambiguous, and you can't change that at all, even if you call it enforcement.
Aren't
that's
dollars,
what the case law holds.
Aren't dollars fungible, though? I mean, you're not changing the ultimate distribution of how many dollars go to each, correct?
Oh, yes, you are.
How
because
is that?
Because the court, in its computations of the distribution of this money, made there is no findings that support that $54,000 that they distributed to the wife. See, that's an additional thing. The court is all screwed up, and the trial court's all screwed up in this. I just want to try to say, I think the case law says that when you have a provision in a judgment decree that is unambiguous and stipulated, you cannot amend that provision, even if it's just for enforcement. But in here, it is not only enforcement, because even the motion that was filed was to amend. They should have brought that motion as part of their motion for a new trial, and they didn't do it. They did it a month later. And I don't think the trial court had jurisdiction to do that.
What case do you think is most on point?
I got to look at my, it's in my responsive motion, and my reply brief. The case I cited summarized all the case law in that area, and it's on page 18 of my reply brief. And if you look, and that is, it's Hansen v. Hansen, 379 Northwest 2nd, 230, citing Stieler, S-T-I-E-L-E-R, and it says, quote, the district court may clarify or interpret the provisions of a decree only when its terms are ambiguous. There is no claim in this case that the terms of that stipulated property settlement to distribute the tangible personal property is ambiguous. This is the benefit of their bargain.
Thank you.
Okay, I want to get on to the home. The issue, essentially, for the wife's non-marital share is this. She owned a property in Bloomington. I call that the Bloomington home. My client, the husband, spent a huge amount of time and effort in fixing up that home so it could be sold. It could not be sold without his work. One of the examples is that he...
But let me interrupt you again. But there was no legally binding agreement that he would get paid for that work, correct? That
was
seems
a gift.
Clear. It was a gift.
Yes.
And so the wife could have said, oh, you worked so hard on helping me fix up my home that I'm not going to claim a non-marital share. But it doesn't alter the fact that it's her money and that was non-marital, particularly in the sense of a gift.
Oh, yes, it does.
I mean, the court could act in, I don't know if this is even right, but let's assume for the sake of this argument that the court could act in equity and say, oh, well, I'm going to award you this, but then that would be a discretionary decision of the district court that we'd have to find an abuse of discretion. What case do you rely on there?
Well, it's the statute. Minnesota statutes, the definitions of non-marital property dealing with gifts. A gift by a third party to one of the spouses but not the other is non-marital property.
That talks about spouse, so that presumes they're married at the time, correct?
Well, it doesn't. No, it does not, because the statute, the non-marital property statute, deals with gifts made before, during, and after the marriage. You just have to read 518.003.
Paragraph talks about a spouse. And the next paragraph B, or clause, I shouldn't say paragraph, but clause B talks about, so these are alternative clauses in the definition of non-marital property. And B says, is acquired before marriage. So this the money from the Bloomington house is money that was from a home that was acquired before marriage, correct?
The Bloomington home was bought by the wife before the marriage, yes.
So that money would constitute, would qualify as non-marital property, correct?
Except that my client, prior to the marriage, substantially invested in that home with all this work. I mean, the house could not have been sold. He had to jack up the joists in the house because they were resting on a jack screw. If you just hear me out just for a moment, is that the non-marital property statute, and I'm quoting, it says, non-marital property means property, real or personal, acquired by either spouse before, during, or after the existence of the marriage.
So why?
Which is acquired by, as a gift, bequest, devise, or inheritance made by a third party to one, but not to the other spouse.
So couldn't we read that section as the husband, the appellant, gave a gift to the wife before they were married, and so his work actually qualifies as the wife's non-marital asset. I mean, isn't that a sensible reading of that provision?
No. The purpose of the provision is to prevent the awkward and inequitable result of one spouse giving something to the other spouse, and then the other spouse getting three-quarters of it. So, for example, like if you give your wife, let's say during the marriage, if your total marital estate is $1,000, and then I give my wife $200, then the total marital estate then is $800. The $200 becomes non-marital, and so that the wife, see, what happens is
did
that
the district
you cannot
court,
convert.
Did the district court enter a finding quantifying, valuing your client's work on the non-marital home of the respondent?
He did quantify it. He estimated it was at least $6,800. But you got to look at the order. See, this judge,
Counsel,
this judge
let's go
said
back
there
to
was
that language
no
that
evidence
that you just read us in Clause A. It says, is acquired as a gift, bequest, devise, or inheritance made by a third party to one but not to the other spouse. So that's talking about a gift by a third party, not either spouse.
That's what makes it non-marital. Gifts between spouses, whether it's before you're married, after you're married, never are non-marital property.
Okay, your time is up, and you still will have time for rebuttal.
Okay.
And we will allow a little extra time if you need it for your argument as well.
Thank you, Your Honors. Wayne Jago on behalf of the respondent. I'll try to be very brief with these issues. The first issue I think I do need to deal with is this child support issue. This issue was agreed to immediately after the decree was entered that the court did it wrong. We actually drafted a stipulation to change that to what the appellant's counsel is asking for, but they refused to sign it. I suspect they want to be a prevailing party here and award costs, but it's not appropriate in this case. We aren't disagreeing with that at all, and we haven't disagreed with it from the get-go.
But do you agree that remand is necessary to...
It shouldn't be because we had a stipulation that took care of the whole works, but they wouldn't sign it. So,
but
yes.
None of the orders... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. If they're not willing to sign the stipulation, it has to be remanded just to correct something that we've already agreed and stipulated to could be corrected. So, yes, I would agree with that.
Thank you.
Your Honor, with regard to the homestead, it was uncontradicted and found by the court that my client had a $17,000 plus non-marital interest that was put into the second home. There was no claims at trial made by the appellant that he was entitled to any payment. There was no claims at trial that they had an agreement that he was going to be paid. There was no claims at trial or evidence put in what the value, increased value of the homestead was because of his efforts. The information at trial was he never put 1 cent into it, he lived there for about a month without having to pay for anything, and both my client, her brother, and he did some work on the property. But there was nothing indicating, other than his testimony, that he thought it was non-saleable if he didn't work things out as far as that was concerned.
Do you agree that the district court entered a finding valuing the work that he did on the home?
I don't think the court did at all. That there was any value put on because there was no evidence at trial. And The court then properly traced the $17,000 into the homestead, and there wasn't a dispute that, or a disagreement that she had put that money into the homestead. What happened after that is once the court got to that point, the court made the wrong decision relying on Senske and saying, well, but after that, they refinanced. And because they refinanced, then the non-marital interest is gone. That's not correct. The Anton case, that which was found the next year, specifically deals with that issue and says, if you have a non-marital interest and the house is refinanced, the refinancing is against the marital portion of the property, not against the non-marital portion.
So can I ask you a question? There were improvements made to the marital home.
Correct.
After that refinancing. And is it also true that there's no evidence in the record of the actual value of that?
Correct.
Work?
It would have been respondent's or appellant's obligation if he believed that the value of the property had been increased subsequent to their purchase to put evidence forward that said, okay, we put this on the house and we've got this appraisal that says now it's worth this much more because just of that event. They didn't put any evidence in to that effect.
So why is the burden on the appellant to have brought forward that evidence?
They're the ones that are arguing that there was additional value put to the property. Our position was Schmitz should be applied, our non-marital should be included in this, and we apply the Schmitz formula and be done. Their argument is, no, wait a minute here. We made some improvements that should increase the value of the property based on the improvements themselves, but they never presented any evidence of it. They never made any argument to that effect. They never gave the court anything to rely on. Now, it's possible that some of the things that they did increase the value, but that was their burden. It wasn't our burden to prove their case, and they didn't do it.
Was the court inconsistent in how it treated closing costs for the purchase of the Northfield home versus the sale of the Northfield home and the application of the 7% to those values?
I'm confused on Appellant's argument on that. The $17,000 that went from the Northfield home had nothing to do with closing costs. She got more than $17,000, got another $4,000 that we didn't make a non-marital claim on. That $17,000 went into the property. I think the court had discretion to determine whether or not we take closing costs into the final calculation. And the court didn't do that, but there's not case law that says you're required to do that. The Schmitz formula itself is based on the value of the homestead at the time of if we wouldn't have sold the house, it would have been based strictly on the value of the homestead. Their argument was they never argued that we should take off the cost of closing prior to making that determination. And the court made the determination, which is within its discretion, to say, no, we're going to take that out of the marital portion and just base it like we would a straight Schmitz calculation.
So in calculating the amount that wife contributed to the non-marital, the amount of non-marital property that the wife contributed to the Northfield home, mm-hmm. originally the value didn't include closing costs. In other words, if I'm remembering correctly, the way it was calculated was the amount that she provided towards the down payment, the $17,000, divided by the purchase price of the home without the closing costs, correct?
Correct. And that the
but
closing-
then in calculating the amount of that she's entitled to after the sale, closing costs were included, correct?
The closing costs were not deducted, but were taken into account.
So is that inconsistent? Does that result in,
I think it was consistent. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I think it was consistent, then the court used the purchase price both times. It just said, here's the value of the house at the time of the purchase, here's what she put into it. Here's the value of the house at the time of sale, here's what she put into it, and based it on that 7%. I tried to find something that would give us a little bit more, that we could rely on more on how that calculation is to be made, but there really isn't anything out there, and I think it's within the court's discretion to do that. And it is a very small amount either way. It's just a few thousand dollars one way or the other. The second issue, that occurred was with regard to these awards of attorney's fees to both parties. The trial court reversed its original decision awarding the appellant $6,000 in conduct-based attorney's fees. And the reason for that is there were no findings. There was no findings whatsoever regarding that issue. And based on that, there's a requirement that findings be made by the court. They weren't made, so the court deleted that calculation. With regard to the award of need-based attorneys, the court made a lot of findings on that. It made a determination as to income. It made a determination as to expenses. It made a determination as to what the awards would be to each party. It made a determination as to what the position the parties would be in financially once the child support and spousal maintenance was. So there were plenty of indications to support the finding that the respondent in this matter did need need-based attorney's fees.
Did the court revisit that after amending the decision about the non-marital interest in the home?
The court made the decision on, they didn't recalculate after doing the non-marital interest of the home? No, they did not at that point. The non-marital interest in the home added about $13,000 to what my client got. So there wasn't a recalculation, as far as I know, or at least listed in the order itself, that indicated they had recalculated anything at that point.
Is that something the court should have done?
I don't think that makes a big difference because they're looking at ability to pay, and that doesn't affect my client's, it affects the amount that she receives as a property settlement, but it doesn't affect the shortage that she's going to have each month in her monthly budget, even with spousal maintenance and even with child support that the court found. I don't think that makes any difference. The argument with regard to the motion by the court, by the decision by the court based on a motion by respondent to disperse, I want to point out the court didn't change the property award in any manner. He's right, there were two different pots, but the one pot, in order to close on the homestead, the only way they would agree to close on the homestead was to divide the property equally. We got the homestead sold because we knew he had other assets that could be taken from if we got a decision in our favor. He still is getting awarded half of the personal property that was that sale, but the court set it off against other amounts that were owed pursuant to the judgment decree. It didn't change the agreement with regard to the personal property in any way. It kept it exactly the same. It just allowed us to disperse funds to make things the way they should have been underneath the judgment and decree after we had already closed on the homestead. One other argument that was brought up by the respondent that I don't think we have dealt with is the appellant in this case believes that there should have been some sort of a mediation. I'm not sure where that came from. We made motions to the court. They answered the motions. They argued the motions. They don't like the decision now, but they never made any claim that mediation should occur at that time, and I think they've waived that right. Based on our brief and argument, I would ask the court to deny all the requests by the appellant, and I would agree that it does need to be remanded to change the child support amount.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I object to counsel's comments. We had mediation, that is not admissible in evidence. It's not admissible here. I object to it, and there's a mischaracterization of it anyway. I want to say this. The Senske case is a complete straw man.
Before you go there, I didn't find in my review, and maybe I missed it because there's so many amended orders, an actual finding by the district court valuing your client's effort in contributions to the wife's non-marital property.
There was not.
Oh, I thought you said there was a finding.
Well, no. The evidence showed my client testified.
Okay. There was no finding by the district court crediting the amount that your client claimed to have expended in labor.
Yes.
In contribution to wife's non-marital asset, the home.
You're correct. The court never found what the value of his efforts were. He testified what the value was, But you need that. But I want to point out the errors on the post-decree. The trial court found that there was no evidence of what the value was. Three times the trial court in three separate sentences said there was no evidence. The trial transcript is replete with evidence. Trial transcript 57-58, trial transcript 91-95, trial transcript 96-97 is testimony by both spouses of what he did and how that improved the home. The problem that counsel, or problem that the respondent has, is that the burden of proof to prove up a non-marital claim is solely on her, period. She is arguing that the burden is on the husband to prove up the value. No.
Well, but didn't she prove the value of what she purchased it for and what it sold for and the amount that she contributed to the down payment?
Well, she can testify to that, but
half. Well, what case requires her to prove the value of the amount of work that husband did and whether that should be deducted?
Well, the statute clearly indicates that all property is not marital property unless it's presumed that all property is marital property unless the proponent of the property that is non-marital shows it. And I think there's many cases that say
that. These funds were funds that were acquired before marriage?
Which funds?
The funds that she contributed to the down payment?
No, the funds that she contributed came from the Bloomington home. The Bloomington home sold the same.
Why doesn't that meet her? But doesn't that establish her burden? Why doesn't that meet her burden? She's saying this is non-marital. This part of it is non-marital because this is what I contributed to it. So why isn't that sufficient to meet her burden? I'm lost in your
argument.
It's
not the money. It's the home, which is the non-marital property, and the sale of that home later on. She has the burden of proof of each and every element of a non-marital claim.
But it's her claim that she's entitled to $17,000. Why is it her burden to prove she's actually entitled to less than $17,000? Then that's 7%.
Because when you apply the Schmitz formula or the Nardini formula, which is a kind of a different variation of it, you have to subtract from the proceeds of sale the value of the non-marital claim. Of the value that was attributable to the efforts. It was her burden of proof to show. If she would have testified that there was no value to what he did, she could have done that, but she didn't. She testified, she admitted value was added. She admitted that the first home couldn't be sold unless that value was added. The home increased in value from about $251,000 up to almost $400,000. It's her burden to prove what portion of that was passive and what portion was active. The case law is crystal clear on that. Much of the value of that home increased because it was because of active participation. That's her burden of proof. I got 23 seconds left. I want to just say, I don't think Judge Carter had any idea what this case was about. He didn't hear the case. He should not have heard the case under Rule 6301 because issues that he decided were based on credibility. Counsel misrepresented to the court that there was no finding for the conduct-based attorney's fees. There was a finding for the fees. The finding was in the conclusions of law. There were no findings for the wife's attorney's fees, and then after the fact, when the court completely redid the judgment decree, his argument that there was all the findings, the maintenance was adequate. That is not adequate.
You're out of time. Thank you very much. The case is submitted, and thank you for your argument.
Thank you.